Chip Khan of the Federation of American Hospitals. Thanks for joining us on health08.org.
My pleasure.
The first question I always ask in these interviews is this. I know that you have a fairly broad agenda in terms of healthcare issues. What does the Federation identify as the single most significant problem facing the system?
Without question, for our members who operate hospitals in many states in the country, we have about 20% of the hospitals in the country, my members identify the lack of coverage or insufficient coverage as the major problem they see for the healthcare system. And that's why last year they developed a healthcare coverage plan, which we call the healthcare passport, coverage passport.
Before we get to that, let me ask you, because we always hear about the strain that hospitals are under because of people who are either uninsured or underinsured. Can you give us some real life experiences that you hear from your members about the kinds of challenges this presents them?
And it really comes from two places right now. And one is, even before the economy began to deteriorate, they were, through even through all the good years, they saw in the emergency room every day, and then obviously every year, more and more uninsured patients. And they have to provide services to those patients. They want to provide services to patients. It's part of their mission. But at the end of the day, something's got to give. Something's got to pay for that. And frankly, they also saw a trend that has started really in the last two or three years, where they see a great deal of change in the health benefits people have, who have coverage, with much higher deductibles. And whereas some would hope, I think, that those deductibles would lead to more cost-conscious purchasing on the part of patients and consumers, instead, what the hospitals see is that many of these people are willing to come into the hospital. Obviously, the insurance pays for part of the cost, and then the hospital is left with an unpaid deductible. And this is a very large problem because they're receiving services, and they have coverage for part of their care, and they're not paying for the other part. So this issue of unpaid, uncompensated care is a growing one. And at the end of the day, someone has to pay for that, and the paying patients, or either those covered by Medicare or those covered by private insurance, are paying that extra cost, and it leads to all kinds of incentives that are problematic and cross-subsidization and increases in everyone's premiums who are paying premiums, and something's got to give here.
Give me some figures on how uncompensated care has grown. Dollar figures, percentage figures over the past 5 or 10 years?
Well, I could say with one particular company, a very large one that I'm familiar with, their uncompensated care numbers have grown by 50% in the last 3 years, and that amounts to billions of dollars. And the actual cost, you know, in the issue of hospitals, you always have this issue of charges versus cost. Their actual cost over their system of many hundreds of hospitals have gone up about $500 million. Those are actual cost for uncompensated care. So that is not a small percentage of the overall cost of uncompensated care in the system.
And so as you mentioned before, the Federation has developed a plan that it calls Health Coverage Passport. Mm-hmm. What is it?
Well, we developed this plan a year ago, and my members wanted to do a number of things. One, they wanted to build on the current system. I mean, their belief was that if we change everything too radically, we first have little political likelihood of getting it through the political system, and second, we don't know what the outcome would be.
So they
built on the private-public mix. They wanted to achieve universality. And so they looked at the various groupings, income groupings, knowing that many people who are uninsured are connected to employment in some way. There are no mandates on employers. There's an individual mandate. But there's heavy subsidization for everyone below 200% of poverty and some subsidization up to 400% of poverty in our plan. And for the least, those who can least afford it, they would go into the public programs that they may not be eligible for now. And for those who have some income or offered coverage by their employers, they would receive a subsidy to help them pay for their coverage.
And through tax credit or?
Well, we didn't want to use the tax system. We actually, in our plan, assumed that you could structure this through Social Security and make sure that everyone would get, in a sense, a piece of paper or a certificate if they were eligible, and receive a subsidy directly to pay the insurance they might have to buy in a reformed insurance market, or hopefully if they're offered insurance by their employer and they're low income enough and they turn the insurance down now, they would receive a subsidy for the amount that the employer charges the employees in their insurance. We actually, our plan would actually end up affecting about 100, 115 million people, more than the 47 million uninsured, because the notion here is that we want to shore up those who are lower income and may be insured now but may not be tomorrow, and we obviously want to help the 47 million. Our impact analysis, we just finished one for 2010, shows that the kind of plan we have that bills on Medicaid, bills on this state child health plan, provides this new subsidy for those who are sort of in between with the ability to either buy into their employer plan or buy into a reformed non-group individual market. We cover all but about 6 or 7 million Americans through our plan, according to an estimate done by Lewin.
And the cost?
Well, there's a big price tag. It's $130 billion in 2010. If you do all the things that we do, and also we assume a benefits package that's equivalent to a standard Blue Cross option in the Federal Employees Health Plan. So it's a very generous benefit package. So there are obviously a lot of gears in our plan that could be adjusted to lower the cost somewhat. We didn't go through an exercise of trying to raise $130 billion a year, but obviously, if we were asked, there's some places you could identify to do it. If you look at the plans that are out there in the presidential race, if they did an estimate for 2010, they would be in the range that we're in. So we're in the sort of given range if you want to get to universality.
Let's suppose for a moment that everything you've just described occurs, is enacted. How does that change the climate for the members of the Federation, for the hospitals? How is it different?
Well, I think I think first the most important thing is to focus on the patients and the medical consumer. I think it gives for patients and for medical consumers the comfort and protection of health care coverage. And if the benefits are good enough, and I think this issue of high deductibles is something we're going to have to grapple with, particularly for lower income people. I think for higher income people, having that kind of skin in the game probably will affect at the margin behavior in an appropriate way. But I think we've got to be very careful with lower income people and how we use copayments. But I think for the consumer, it will help them. It'll give them better access, hopefully better access to more appropriate care. And at the end of the day, that means hospitals can do what hospitals are supposed to do. And hospitals are generally acute care institutions. We're there to take care of people when they get sick, but hopefully they're not coming to us unless sort of everything was done and it's sort of the place of last resort to go from a health standpoint.
But you began the conversation by talking about the tremendous burden of uncompensated care. What happens to that?
Well, I think from an economic standpoint, if you lower the uncompensated care, and I should say that even in our plan, everyone wouldn't be covered because it's America, and even if you had an individual mandate, there would still be issues of compliance. But if most people were covered, it means that hospital finance would change radically, I think, because you wouldn't have to rob Peter to pay Paul that goes on now in hospitals. So I think when people come in, everyone has insurance, basically. Maybe a few don't, but basically everybody does. It reduces your intake costs. Mm-hmm. It reduces a lot of the dealings that have to go on between patients and hospitals regarding the financing side, because you're just going to copy the the insurance card and basically process them in. So I think in terms of the relations between patients and hospitals, it'll make it easier, simpler, and people can focus on the health and medical side of things and not have to worry as much about the financial side. In terms of the finances of hospitals, I think it will remove the necessity to have all this indirect subsidization. And so I think in terms of the amount that hospitals end up working out for payment with insurers and with Medicare and with Medicaid in the states, I think it'll lead to a lot clearer understanding of what true costs are in hospitals, and I think probably more efficiency.
But still unlikely that a single organization's plan would drive this very large debate. So what do you think needs to happen in the next year or so for real movement to be made, either on your plan, someone else's plan? Do the traditionally warring parties need to sit at the same table? Is that under discussion?
I think that's a much bigger question. I mean, we put our plan out there as a marker to say that with the ingredients of the current system, we can have universal coverage, and to sort of show how that could be done. In terms of actually getting something done, I think that is a very difficult one. I think there have to be a number of ingredients. I mean, first, to do anything, whether it's universal coverage or at least significant change, you've got to have presidential leadership. You've got to have the will in the White House to work through the legislative system a major change in how healthcare is financed. And I would argue probably you'll get into how healthcare is delivered, because the healthcare cost issue is going to be part of the package, as well as the appropriateness and quality of care that's being provided to people who will hopefully be now covered under any plan. So that's one ingredient you've got to have. Second, I do think in terms of the outside world, the Main Street America, the sun and the moon has to come together. I mean, employers and consumers and labor and, I mean, those who would pay the bill and those who would receive the coverage all have to come to some kind of general consensus, or at least a majority of them, that something ought to give here, something ought to happen, so that the legislators will have the political will to do things that will...
that they understand the different parties could agree on.
Well, could it agree on, or at least come to some consensus on? Mm-hmm. I almost would rather use the word consensus than agreement, because I don't think that everyone's going to get their ideal solution. And I don't think everyone's going to be 100% happy with the outcome. But I think if they are satisfied that it was worth the journey, and that overall it's better for the average American and everyone who's paying the bills, I think that's the kind of outcome we'd want to seek.
And where would the Federation draw the line in the sand? Where would you be willing to move to reach consensus, and where would you be unwilling?
Well, you know, one is always reticent to negotiate with themselves. But I think from the standpoint of hospitals, the rub comes on the financing side, obviously, because the issue is going to be, if we're going to cover everyone, if we're going to have universality through whatever model you choose, and there are many models, or if we're going to cover a significant number of Americans, policymakers are going to look back at hospitals and say, well, what are you going to contribute? And if we look at Massachusetts, for example, there was an indigent hospital fund in Massachusetts of some many hundreds of millions of dollars that was used to help fund some of the insurance purchasing under the Massachusetts model of healthcare coverage that's now in place. So I think, and also if you look at California and the debates there, there are tremendous problems in California with Medi-Cal, Medicaid payment in California, and the governor wanted to put on a hospital tax, mm-hmm, as part of his package, and so there were things worked out there. So at the end of the day, whether it's disproportionate share payment, payments that are made under Medicare or Medicaid for hospitals treating sicker, poorer patients, or other kinds of subsidies that hospitals get right now in existing programs, I think people are going to look at hospitals and say, okay, how much of that are you going to give up? And part of the issue will be, the balancing act will be, are we going to see enough covered people through the reform that it will balance out and hopefully be a little bit more than whatever would be lost if there are changes. Obviously, we're not advocating any cuts in hospital payment, but if we're realistic, those are the kinds of things that will be discussed.
A final question. As you know from having worked in Washington for as many years as you have, there is a cyclical nature to the conversation you and I are having.
Yeah.
Is this time any different?
Probably. Well, there's specific aspects of it that are different. I mean, I think we're at a point now in the development of the healthcare system where I think we know a lot less or have to be less confident about the model for reform than we might have been in the early 90s. If you go back to the
you
early...
You know less now
right,
than...
Right. I think if you go back to the early 90s, both the private sector and Medicare had come to a point, and I think the healthcare intelligentsia generally, had come to a point where some version of managed care was accepted, health maintenance organizations, whatever, mm-hmm. as an organizing center for delivery that also would play a role in more efficient and maybe more effective financing of care. And the organization of how to get from point A to point B in healthcare coverage, I think there was a lot more confidence about. So whether you were on the right or the left, you sort of accepted that. Now, obviously, in the Clinton care, they wanted to use the alliances as the ways that private managed care and HMOs would market themselves, and there was great disagreement about how that would work. But I think there was a paradigm that efficiency and cost effectiveness could be brought about through this integrated delivery organizing. And the fact is, other than a few HMOs around the country, I'm not sure it was ever as integrated or organized as people thought. And as you go through the 90s, you know, it's interesting, 96 is sort of the key year. There were very few premium increases in 96. Mm-hmm. It was the most effective year, in a sense, for managed care controlling costs. It also was sort of the key year when patient protection and concern about aspects of managed care were bothering the consuming public. And now you see a system that we can call a lot of different things, other than a few places around the country that have old-style HMOs, is really sort of a fee-for-service kind of system. And even with the great understanding now, I think, that was so focused with the Institute of Medicine a few years ago, raising the quality issue and raising the issue of integration in of healthcare for the average American, we are further, I think, from having a model as to how to make changes. I mean, many of us are involved in much more measurement, and there's discussion of comparative effectiveness of therapies. But there really is no, I would argue, organizing model that we could generally accept that would show us how to get from point A to point B, other than this old insurance model in terms of getting coverage that's out there. So I am extremely worried that the infrastructure is not well suited for reform. That's one thing. Second, we all are in agreement, I think, that changes in our system, better care for chronically ill Americans, really, and other aspects of change and improving quality really depend on primary care. And if anything, our primary care across the country has deteriorated, not because we don't have good physicians or nurse practitioners, but because we don't have enough of them. And if everyone was covered, this is something that's come out in Massachusetts recently, if everyone was covered, I'm not sure the primary care practitioners would be there. So I think that things have changed, and I'm not sure for the positive, in terms of the infrastructure, before you even get to all the complexities of health reform.